We're doing the Rambam's intro to Sefer HaMitzvot, and we were in the middle of the Ramban, and if you recall, we read the Ramban's introduction, that the Ramban's goal is to defend the earlier commentaries who the Rambam attacks. And we had read the Rambam's defense of Baal Halachos Gedolos, and the Ramban had shown why Baal Halachos Gedolos will enumerate within the 613, he will enumerate some rabbinic mitzvot. He gave multiple answers. He said, you know, Baal Halachos Gedolos had a different version in the Gemara. You know, in his version of the Gemara, it said the Jewish people have 613 mitzvot. It didn't say that 613 were given at Sinai. So yes, the part of the 613 we have are rabbinic. And he said, even if you'd say it says at Sinai, sometimes we speak about the general flow of things. If 7 of the 613 were not at Sinai, you could still say 613 were given at Sinai. And he proved it from many sources. And he gave other answers to protect Baal Halachos Gedolos. And now he's going to contend with the second claim that Maimonides had made against Baal Halachos Gedolos, against Rav Yehuda Gaon. So he says, "Uvatshuva shenit chatam tochnit chadash or charash al baal halachot herich lemanit." And in his second claim, he really had it out with Baal Halachos Gedolos. Amalzal, Maimonides made a claim against Baal Halachos Gedolos, and he said, "Imana kol mashud rabanan mipnei shu bichlal lo tasur." If the logic of Baal Halachos Gedolos in enumerating the rabbinic mitzvot was because Baal Halachos Gedolos is of the opinion that when the Torah says you have to listen to the rabbis, then that means that anything the rabbis tells you falls under the category of the 613. If that's the logic, that because the Torah says listen to them, so then anything they say falls under the heading of the 613. Well, if that's the case, so then said the Rambam, "Leize davar pirtu elu yoter mezulatam." Then why did he only enumerate some of the rabbinic mitzvos? How did he decide which count is part of the 613 and which do not? Just as they enumerated lighting Hanukkah candles and reading the Megillah on Purim as part of the 613, they should have also enumerated washing hands and making an Eruv. We make a blessing that God commanded us to wash our hands. If that's the logic, well then, we make that blessing on washing hands too. Why doesn't that count? Ve'eruv, and when we place an Eruv, we also make a blessing that God commanded us on mitzvat Eruv. Just as we make a blessing on reading the Megillah and Hanukkah candles. Ve'akol midrabanan, all these things are rabbinic, but they all get the same blessing. Ubeveyur amru, and the Talmud clearly says, Mayim rishonim mitzvah, washing our hands firstly, before the meal, is a mitzvah. Amar Abaye, so Abaye explained, what does it mean? It's a mitzvah. Mitzvah lishma divrei chachamim. Doesn't mean it's a biblical mitzvah. It's a mitzvah to listen to the rabbis. Moshe amru b'mgila v'ner Chanukah, like the Talmud says, with regard to Megillah and lighting Hanukkah candles, the Talmud says, how do you make a blessing that God commanded us to do these things? They are rabbinic. The Talmud questions, heichan tzivanu, where did God tell us to do this? We make a blessing, Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvotav etzivanu. God sanctified us with His mitzvos and commanded us to read Megillah, commanded us to light Hanukkah candles. So the Talmud questions, where did God ever command us to light Hanukkah candles or read Megillah? And the Talmud answers, milot asu, being that the Torah says, do not stray from what the rabbis tell you, stay in line with tradition, and that's like the God told you to do what they say. V'zot ha'tshuva echmir ba'arav me'od. And the rabbi, meaning Nachmanides is calling Maimonides the rabbi, he says, you know, Maimonides took this claim very seriously. V'amar, and Maimonides went so far as to say, k'yotam monim k'tzat ha'dvarim she'mid rabbanan u'minichim k'tzatam b'v'chiratam mehim, that being that he doesn't see any consistency with Baal Halachos Gedolos, he enumerates some of the rabbinic mitzvos, and he does not enumerate others. Maimonides said, "Zedavar lo yishma'eu v'lo yikableu b'shum panim amro m'shamro." That's something that's completely unacceptable. I don't care who says it. Maimonides went so far as to say that about Rav Yehuda Gaon. So Nachmanides says, "Vani tameh al harav b'pliya azot sheitpale." Nachmanides says, and I got to tell you, I am in wonderment over Maimonides' wonderment. Maimonides wonders about Baal Halachos Gedolos, while I'm in wonderment about Maimonides. Because the logic that's behind not enumerating, making an Eruv, that's very clear. Because the whole concept of Eruv is not a new concept that they initiated, so you can't count that. They didn't invent anything new. לאו, כלומר שיהיה אסור להוציא מרשות היחיד לחצר המשותף בלא עירוב, הרי העובר עליו עבר הלא תעשה מלאכה מדבריהם. Okay, so here, how does it say by you?
What?
I gotta see your version. I think the wording is slightly different. Okay, so he says like this. If they were, what's the whole concept of Eruv? The concept of Eruv is that King Solomon saw that everyone lived around the courtyard, right? So everyone has their private home, and then they have a courtyard which all the individuals use together. So far, so good? Okay, so King Solomon said, people are going to carry things from their home, which is private domain, to the courtyard, which is also private domain. It's the private domain of all the 50 houses that live around the same courtyard, right? But what do people see? They say to themselves, when I go to the courtyard, I have 50 families that live around this courtyard with all their children. We have 300 people that live in this courtyard. It's hustling and bustling. In the average person's eyes, he says to himself, what's the difference between this courtyard and public domain? If I can carry around in this courtyard, if I could take things out of my house into the courtyard, well then, before you know it, people will also take things out of the courtyard into the public domain, which is a biblical prohibition. So King Solomon instituted that if you want to carry around in a courtyard, if you want to take things out of your home into the courtyard, even though technically, biblically, the courtyard is private domain, it's owned by all these private entities, all the people who live privately over there, and it's an enclosed quarter, so it's private domain. But in order to ensure that people don't confuse this very public private domain, very public because there are a lot of people there, private domain, with the real public domain on Shabbos, Shlomo said, if you want to carry around in that private domain, you have to make an Eruv. What is an Eruv? Eruv means to mix together. Le'arev, to mix. Shlomo said, what you have to do is, all 50 families have to put food in one family's house. We say, where are you for Shabbos? Well, wherever I have a meal, right? Where you eat, that's where you are for Shabbos. I'll see if I can get a meal in Tzfat, I'm going to be in Tzfat for Shabbos, right? People usually define where they are by where they eat. So Shlomo said, if we take a basket, and every family puts in a pita or something, you know, they all gather, they have a basket which has everyone's food together, and they put it in Chaim's home. So Chaim, in his home, has everyone's food together. What are they doing? They're saying, we're all together in Chaim's home. We're all unifying together our rights. We're all putting together as though we all live together in Chaim's home. Now, we're all one family. Yeah? We're all one big happy family. So then one big happy family could use their yard together. I won't confuse it with the public domain where they're not all one big happy family. You have a bunch of strangers. Now that we all eat together, even though technically we won't, right? You don't eat together. But the fact that we all put our food together is indicative of the fact that we're all unified. If we're all unified, then we're a separate entity from the public domain. Now, all the families understand that the reason we can carry around in this courtyard is because it's not a public domain, it's because it's all of our private domain. We made an Eruv. We all are united. Yeah? So an Eruv is a way of unifying all the people together to get them to understand that there's a difference between this private domain and the public domain. So far, so good? So now we know what an Eruv is. Now, Maimonides claimed against Baal Halachos Gedolos, why don't you count the mitzvah of making an Eruv? Shlomo, King Solomon said, you can't carry around in the courtyard without making an Eruv. So why don't you count that as one of the mitzvos? If you're going to count other rabbinic mitzvos, why don't you count that one? So Nachmanides says, wait a second. Did they invent a new concept? The Torah says you can't carry from private to public domain. What did King Solomon say? I don't want you to confuse the courtyard with another public domain. So I'm going to tell you, don't carry in the courtyard without making an Eruv. But what did he do here? He was just ensuring that a biblical mitzvah remains intact. He didn't invent something new. Yeah, he instituted that you won't carry in the courtyard without an Eruv. But is that really a new concept? It's a rabbinic prohibition to ensure the biblical prohibition doesn't get transgressed. Says Nachmanides, if the rabbis would come along and say, with regard to the mitzvah of Eruv, Ela imam hu b'mitzvat ha'eruv lav, if they would come and say, we're inventing a rabbinic prohibition. Klomar, if they would say, she'asur lo'otzi mirshut ha'yechid lechatzer ha'mshutaf b'lo eruv, harei ha'over alav avar alot asem lacham divrayem. If they would say, now we're making a rabbinic prohibition. You're not allowed to take out of your house into the courtyard without making an Eruv. So then if you transgress, then you transgressed a rabbinic prohibition, right? The imam who, and if the way they set up this institution was beiruv with regarding to an eruv, shvut meotzaazo hareu bichlal shvita. If they said we want to make a prohibition to ensure you rest on Shabbos, the Torah says tishbot. Torah says I want you to rest on Shabbos. The rabbis understood from the fact that the Torah reiterated, I want you to rest on Shabbos, that the rabbis have a special commandment with regard to Shabbos. Different than any other mitzvah. With regard to Shabbos, the Torah added a point and said, I want you to rest. What's the Torah saying? Explained the rabbis, the Torah was saying, I want the rabbis to institute more prohibitions, to make more guidelines to ensure that you rest on Shabbos. Meaning, it's not enough what the Torah said. And it's not like any other area of Torah where the rabbis have a right to make a rabbinic prohibition to ensure that you keep the biblical one. When it comes to Shabbos, the Torah reiterated and said, I want you to rest. And what the Torah was saying is, I want the rabbis to make further institutions to ensure that you rest. And so when we discuss rabbinic prohibitions of Shabbos, very often we will call them Shavuot or Shavuot. What are we saying? We're saying it stems from this biblical commandment of rest. You guys with me? So we have most rabbinic halachot of Shabbos fall under this category. They're there to ensure that we rest on Shabbos. So Nachmanides says, if they said the imam hu be'eruv, and if they said with regard to this institution of eruv, shvot me'otzazo, I want you to rest from taking out from your house to the courtyard without making an Eruv, doesn't sound like it, right? Because they said make an Eruv and then you could take out. But if that was the idea, hareu bichlal shvita, then it falls under the canopy, under the heading of shvita, of rest. V'shvot midivrehem melacha achati, mekama melachot sheshabat, because the concept of shvot encompasses many different melachos. And in many areas, our rabbis said, don't do it because we want you to rest on Shabbos. Okay, before we continue, yes, Bitzalel.
But this situation of rest is not, like here he's talking about rest when it comes to melachot, not rest as resting, like I'm tired, I'm going to rest. It's not
exactly right, right.
This era that he's describing is different than the era that we use sometimes in today's life.
There are three types of Eruv. There's Eruv Chatzeros, which is what we described.
Okay.
And then there's Shetufei Mevaot, which is just like an Eruv Chatzeros. They gave it a different name so you could discern between the two. What Shetufei Mevaot does is, let's say we have a dead-end street. Now around this dead-end street, you have a bunch of courtyards that each have 50 houses around them. So down this dead-end alley, you have 500 families with all the children. You have 2,000 people. Okay? Now, this dead-end street is walled all around, meaning it's really halachically private domain. It's not public domain. It's the private domain that these 2,000 families use. That's their dead-end block. So Shlomo HaMelech instituted not only an Eruv for all the houses to use the central courtyard, but he applied the same concept, and then he said, now, all the courtyards have to combine, again, and they have to unify. This time they don't have to put it in someone's house. They could put it in one of the yards. But they all have to unify, fund together some meals that they're all a partner in order to be able to use that mavui, to be able to use that dead-end street. And he said another thing, to ensure that after they make the Eruv, you know, if you have 2,000 people walking around that dead-end street, and then you have public domain where you have 2 million people walking, sometimes people are going to miss that this is where I'm crossing over into public domain. So King Solomon also instituted that you have to put either a stick on top so that you could see where the end of the dead end, you know, where public domain begins, a stick on top of the entrance, or you have to put a stick on the side of the entrance. You have to put some sign that denotes where our dead end street ends and where the public domain begins, or where our dead end street, you know, where's the limit between them. So that's Shittufei Mevaot. And that's what?
There is such thing in Israel, like in the borders of the roof, there is something in Israel.
That's a different thing, but technically, yes.
Okay, because in some cities I've saw the end of the roof, there is nothing around.
So there are a lot of. Wait. There's. Okay.
Arad, for instance. We saw desert and we saw city. Bet Shean. Bet Shean, there is highway, and start up the city, just have streams.
So the strings, okay. So then,
because you know that's in Europe, but there is nothing written.
Doesn't have to be written. Okay.
It's the sign of the roof.
It's not the sign, it is the roof.
But by seeing the roof, that's the sign.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
So, wait a second. First of all, you said there was three.
The third one is the one we're going to be doing Erev Rosh Hashanah, Erev Tavshilin.
Okay.
Totally different type of Erev.
Again, right now we have an Erev that encloses all of Jerusalem. Now, that's not really what you just described in the second one, where it was a courtyard of dead-end street land. So this is kind of, like, his whole point is that they're not into something new, but is it not something new that you can carry across an entire city where there definitely are Rishut the Rabbim, not just courtyards?
No, if there are Rishut the Rabbim, then you don't have an Erev.
Right.
There's no such thing as an Erev in Rishut the Rabbim. If there's Rishut the Rabbim, Erev is only in areas that really, biblically, are private domain. Okay, so the Ramban is continuing on his counterattack against the Rambam.
Does that mean that halachically, without the Erev, we can still carry in the outside in the streets?
Rabbinically, no. Biblically, yes.
Biblically, yes.
Yes.
Ah, okay.
I'm confused.
It's rabbinically prohibited. It's not biblically prohibited.
To carry on what?
To carry in the streets. Our streets are not public domain. We don't have 2 million people in our streets. You have to have 2 million people.
So it's just if the Erev falls and you're caught with something, it's just a rabbinic. It's a rabbinic.
Right.
Say it.
I mean, if you're in Midtown Manhattan has Rishus HaRabim D'Oraisa. You know, they have streets that have 2 million people. You go to Queens, you might have, I don't know, you know, you go to Brooklyn, I don't know, maybe. You might have a biblical public domain, and then there's no Erev. I mean, there's no Erev that could encompass it. You could have an Erev on two sides of Rishus HaRabim, that's fine.
That's not going to help you.
But,
I'm just confused. In order to be public domain, there is a need for it to exist. 2,000 people?
2 million people? People so according to some.
So if you live in a small village, if there is no roof, there is no prohibition to carry down the street?
No, there's a rabbinic prohibition.
Okay.
The Erev is all rabbinic. Okay, biblically, there's no problem.
If there is like something, I don't know, something out of this world, you could carry.
Look, in order to ensure that people don't take this prohibition lightly, the rabbis forbade a biblical mitzvah of blowing shofar on Shabbos, on Rosh Hashanah, right? So we got to be very careful with this. You see that Chazal, half of the tractate Shabbos focuses on this prohibition. All of Maseches Erevin is about this prohibition. You see that...
Yeah, this actually is to revise, so I got confused, because that was the idea I had, like some kinds of the Erevin we have now is just rabbinically?
No, every Erev is rabbinic. No such thing as a biblical Erev.
The reshuts.
So that's a machlokas. Depends if you're a Sephardi or an Ashkenazi. Meaning, we Ashkenazim, for us it's pretty clear that you have to have 2 million people, you have to have it wide 16 amos, 32 feet, and we don't have 2 million people. Another opinion that's very strong in Halacha is that Rishus HaRabim has to go straight from one end of town to the other end of town. All of our streets turn. It's another reason why we probably don't have Rishus Ram Deoraisa according to many opinions in Halacha. I'm just giving you opinions to rely on, but for Sfaradim it's not so simple. That's why many Sfaradim don't rely on the Erev, because according to Sfaradim you don't necessarily need 2 million people, and then you might have Rishus Ram Deoraisa all over, and then there's no Erev. There's no such concept as an Erev where you have Rishus Ram Deoraisa.
So where can we put the, where can you what Carmelites? Where can we have Carmelites in the middle of all these subjects? Carmelites, place of 6,000 people, that's everything, no?
No, Carmelite is something in between Rishus Ram and Rishus Yachid. A Carmelite is a Makom Ptur that Chazal decided to forbid. Let's leave that for now. Okay, back to the Ramban. So the Ramban in his counterattack says to the Rambam, so to speak, V'chinavi bichlal cheshbon ha-mitzvot. And according to you, Maimonides, would you also want us to include in the enumeration of the 613 mitzvot ha-motzi le-karmelit shehu midivriyem? The rabbinic prohibition of taking out into a karmelis, meaning biblically, you have three types of domains. You have Rishus Rabim, that's public domain, that's defined by an area that's not walled and has, as we said, a straight street that has 2 million people on it and is at least 16 amos wide, 32 feet wide. That's Rishus Rabim. Rishus HaYochid is defined as something that has at least three walls, right? It's an area that has at least three walls. So if you have three walls that are 10 tefachim, technically you're Rishus HaYochid. Doesn't matter who it's owned by, but technically if it's an enclosed area, that's Rishus HaYochid. And then you have a million things that are in between. You know, so all these things that are in between biblically are a makom pitur. They're biblically, they are a place where you could take from there into Rishus Rabim and from there into Rishus HaYochid, and you could carry all around there. The rabbis came and said, wait, we're going to forbid some of those places because they're too close to being a public domain. And those are called karmelis. So when the rabbis forbade this domain called the karmelis, says Nachmanides, would you want us to enumerate that? What were they forbidding? Really, they were just expanding the prohibition of carrying public domain. They said, the Torah prohibits public domain. You have areas that are similar to public domain, but they're not exactly public domain. Well, we're not going to let you do that. We're not going to let you carry there. For example, most of our streets are karmelis, right? Our streets. They're not walled with three walls. We said, when is a mavoi considered Rishus HaYochid? When is a mavoi private domain? When is it? Because it's a dead-end street. It has three walls. Our streets don't have any walls. So our streets are all karmelis. Technically, biblically, you could carry all around there. The rabbis came and forbade it. They said it's a karmelis. You can't carry around there. Yeah? Okay. So says Nachmanides, the whole idea of karmelis is, go explain to people that this isn't public domain. You know? So the rabbi said, okay, you can't carry there. Are you going to count that as one of the 613 too? Yes.
What happened to the idea of putting in all the food together?
That's good for an area which we said is a Rishus HaYochid.
I'm saying, but today we don't do that.
Well, we don't... So, you guys want all of Irvin on one foot. Okay, let's leave that. If you want... So tell me before next Thursday night and we'll see if guys want us to set aside a time and we'll go through all the basic concepts of Erev. Okay?
Okay.
Fair enough. Then Rovina Gabei Beima. And we have, if you want, just look at Rav Kahati's introduction to Erevin and you'll understand.
Yeah.
The rabbi said, even though an animal technically carries itself, and it makes no difference to an animal whether you're on its back or not, a live animal carries itself. Torah says, you can't cause the animal to move. That's a biblical prohibition called mechamer. But let's say you're not going to cause it to move. You know that your animal, you know, is going to run over there to the meadow. So you want to hop on its back and go? You're not telling it to go anywhere, right? If you tell it to go, if you tell your animal to work on Shabbos, that's a biblical prohibition. But let's say you're not going to tell it to go. It's just going and you decide you're going to go for a stroll. So you're going to sit on the horse and it's going to carry you all around. So the rabbis forbade that. The rabbi said, you're going to ride on the horse, you're going to end up pulling off a twig to hit it, you're going to do biblical prohibitions. The rabbis forbade riding on an animal even when you're not the one telling it where to go. The en shatin up na'amayim, the rabbis forbade a person to swim, a person to take a boat on Shabbos. All the different rabbinic prohibitions that the rabbi said, we want you to rest and don't do them. What are you going to say? They should all count as part of the 613 Maimonides. But they all fall under the greater category of the biblical mitzvot of Shabbat. Just like we know there are 39 prohibited activities, biblically prohibited activities on Shabbos, and yet they all fall under one category of Shabbos. You don't count them as 39 mitzvot in the 613. You say, there's one mitzvah of not doing work on Shabbos, and then comes as all 39. And by the same token, when you have the prohibition, don't walk beyond 2,000 footsteps on Shabbos, 2,000 footsteps outside the city. That's also for the same reason. It falls under the same heading. So he says, when he asks us about an Eruv, he says, I don't accept that question. What's the question? You know, things fall under a larger heading. The whole concept of Eruv falls under the larger heading of the prohibitions of carrying things on Shabbos. So the rabbis added a certain technicality. They said, we don't want you to carry without this institution. Is that a new invention? Should that be a new mitzvah? You don't count the 39 different actions that are prohibited on Shabbos as 39 separate mitzvot. So now you'll count the detail that the rabbis instituted in carrying on Shabbos as a separate mitzvah. He says that I don't understand the Rambam. He says he wonders about the Hag and I wonder about him. But his other question, why doesn't Baal Halachas Gedolos count washing one's hands? Yesh botam al dad Baal Halachot. That, going with the logic of Baal Halachas Gedolos, that really makes sense to ask that. Shein nitilat yadayim lechulin mishum mitzvah shechitshu sofrim ela gzira mishum tuma. The idea that we wash our hands for eating chulin, for eating food that's not holy, really is not its own institution, but rather the rabbis said, you have to wash your hands for eating holy food. And then they said, we're going to extend it and tell you, you have to wash your hands for eating regular food. But it's really an extension of the fact that we have to wash our hands for holy foods. Like the Talmud says in chulin, enitilat yadayim lechulin. Technically, you don't have to wash your hands for eating food that's not holy. Ela mishum srach truma. It's only an extension. Our sages said, if you don't get accustomed to washing for eating bread that's not holy, you'll also end up eating bread that's holy without washing your hands. So it's really an extension of that. Uvetruma tzma, and when it comes to the holy food itself, the truma itself, the Talmud tells us, why do we wash our hands before eating truma? That's not biblical either. It's one of the 18 things the rabbis decreed. And this is where we left off, guys. Till here was review. Yeah. You guys remember? We discussed what were the 18 things that the rabbis instituted. There was a day when the rabbis, Beis Shammai, outnumbered Beis Hillel. And when Beis Shammai outnumbered Beis Hillel, so they took advantage. You know, it's like when the Democrats get a hold of Congress. So they make all the decrees they can. And they got away with 18 decrees on that day. Wow, massive day. And last time we discussed what were the 18 decrees. You guys are welcome to go online. I don't think we're going to do it again. Okay, we discussed, you don't remember?
Of course.
Eating the food that was holy because you might end up drinking as you eat it. We discussed a person who takes a shower that he's defiled. Yeah, because their mikveh waters were stinky and the people would take showers after the mikveh and they were scared the people would start thinking it's the shower that gets me pure and not the mikveh. So they made an institution that anyone who showers is defiled. Bezalel's? I guess it was just you and me.
I don't remember.
Yeah. It's all posted online. Gidulei Truma Trumain, that if you take Truma seeds and you plant them right, you weren't here that night. It was the last Thursday night of the semester. And I remember. You for sure weren't here.
Yeah, I didn't come.
Right.
Yeah, I was flying.
Okay. So this is where we left off. You guys are welcome to see it online. We did it. We went through all 18. So at any rate, Yeah.
Sorry. Okay, since we review with just, I don't know if you can answer this in a minute, in a short sense. It said that if a person eats bread without washing, there might be a problem that he might eat the holy bread without washing. So, but to eat the holy bread with kohanim?
Holy bread, I meant truma bread.
Okay.
I mean, okay, so that's also only kohanim, right?
Okay, but it could be a mitzvah for kohanim only instead of for the general.
Okay. Bread. For whatever reason, the rabbi saw fit to make it a general. I don't know how to explain it more than that. I don't know.
We are all called kohanim and kedushim, you know?
Yeah, but that's not the idea. The idea is that, look, whatever I'm going to say now is my own guess and understanding the Gemara's saying it's an extension of Truma. So let's leave it with what the Gemara said. And when you get to the Gemara in Hulin, you look into it and see if you could get a better picture of it. The Gemara says it's an extension of Truma. You're saying, but Truma is Kohanim and we're not Kohanim? It's a good question. Okay. So, the Ramban says, okay, we wash our hands for bread as an extension of Truma. They have to wash their hands for Truma as a rabbinic decree. It's one of those 18 things that Bichama got away with. Okay, none of you remember. We discussed over there. They decreed all the daughters of the Kutim would be defiled. Not Kutim Nidot Marisotahim. Because they wouldn't watch their daughters, and they might see a girl can sometimes see a little bit of blood when she's a day old.
I guess it was here. I remember that.
You remember? So, we discussed the guy who's coming home on Erev Shabbos, and the sun sets, and can he put his wallet on the donkey, and the donkey will carry his wallet. The 18 things, we discussed it. That's when they decreed on Stam Yenam that you're not allowed to eat their bread, that you're not allowed to drink their wine. That was all that day. That was one of the 18 things. They decreed you're not allowed to eat their bread because you might drink their wine, their oil. You can't have their oil because you might drink their wine. You can't have their wine because you might come to do idol worship with them. But bread, oil, wine were all decreed on that day. Pat akum, that you don't eat non-Jewish bread because you'll end up being friendly with him. You eat his bread, he eats your bread. We're talking about all kosher ingredients, and then your son meets his daughter. When Harry met Sally, we know what goes next. Okay, so that's why they forbade eating non-Jewish bread, and then they forbade drinking non-Jewish wine. That's stam yenam. That was all that day, and then they forbade davar achel mishum davar achel. Then they also said that. You shouldn't let your kids play with their kids because they'll teach them that boys can sleep with boys.
So Netilat Yadayim comes from Beit Shammai?
It's one of these 18. Oh, so Netilat Yadayim for Truma comes from Beit Shammai. And then Netilat Yadayim, but it's everyone, we all accepted it.
Yeah.
So the Tosefta says a discussion among the rabbis, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Eliezer, they all discuss, was that day a good day in Jewish history or a bad day in Jewish history? So you have the opinion of that. I think it's Rabbi Yeshua. One opinion says, that day, they really packed it in. They got it exactly right. They put us exactly where we should be. And the other opinion says, that day they made the measurement overflow. They went too far, and that day was difficult to the Jewish people, as difficult as the day that we did the Egel. That's a Lashon in the Tosefta. Yeah.
So
that if Beis Shammai gets a hold of the Beis Medrash, they get too tough on us. It's as bad as the eagle. So that needs work. How do you compare, Okay.
So the Truma Netilat is the Beis Shammai institution.
Truma, right. But again, we're oversimplifying because the Gemara works on this for a whole page. What was the involvement? Shammai tried to institute it. They didn't listen to him. Shammai and Hillel tried to institute it. They didn't listen to him. Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, they didn't listen to him. And they finally got away with it on this day. So what stage did they get away with? What did Shlomo Melch institute? Because Shlomo Melch also did Netil Sidayim. So Talmud says Shlomo did for Kachim. They did for Truma and Meiser. So it's a whole involvement over there. At any rate, it was about this generation that they instituted also washing your hands for Hulin. So, the Ramban says, what Maimonides is claiming against Baal Halachos Gedolos, now that's a real claim, because let's analyze Netil Sidayim. We wash our hands for regular bread as an extension of washing our hands for Truma. And washing our hands for Truma was a rabbinic decree, it was one of the 18. But if anyone eats truma when their body is defiled, that's a biblical prohibition. And the biblical prohibition of eating truma when one is defiled, well, that's already been enumerated. And this encompasses all the defilements, biblical, rabbinic, in general. ומה שאמרו ועוד משום מצווה, ופירש אביי מצווה לשמוע דברי חכמים, ויוצא זו מה שאמרו או מה שאמר? Okay. And furthermore, the Gemara says you do it because of the mitzvah. The Gemara says you have to wash your hands. That's that Gemara in Chulin. The Gemara says you have to wash your hands before you eat bread. That's a mitzvah. The Upiresh Abaye, and Abaye explains over there, what's the mitzvah to wash your hands before you eat bread? Mitzvah lishma divrei chachamim. It's a mitzvah to listen to the sages. Hi a mitzvah zo beatzma sheraui leachil hakol betahara. That's this mitzvah, that you should eat everything with purity. So far, so good? So the rabbi said, we want you to purify your hands. You have to understand, this is really a new invention, because technically, biblically, either the whole body is pure, or the whole body is defiled. No such concept as the hands having their own defilement. You know, they're part of a greater body. Either the body is tahor, or the body is tameh. That's from the Torah's perspective. But the Torah does say, if someone eats food, and he didn't purify his hands, so he'll get cut off from the Jewish people. So the rabbis automatically ask, wait a second, what do you mean? Biblically, there's no such concept as washing your hands. How could only the hands be defiled? So the rabbis say a whole derivation over there, and they say it doesn't mean literally hands. It means the whole body's tameh. Why did it say hands? To teach us a concept of tumat bet estarim, that just like the hands are revealed, tumah has to touch you in a place that's revealed. If a person, he goes diving, and he touches something under his armpit, and he's not sure, maybe it was a sheretz, maybe it was a defiled, dead, creepy, crawly creature, right? One of the eight. So we say, you have to come in contact with tumah in a place that's revealed. That's why the Torah said his hands were defiled, to tell us that defilement has to come through a part of the body that's revealed. Tumat bet astarim, if you have a tumah in a place that's covered, so then we have certain leniencies. But wait a second, what did the verse say? The verse said, if he ate it and his hands were defiled. That's what the verse said. So, you know, the rabbis have a whole derivation to say, well, it doesn't mean that. But that's what it says. So along come the rabbis, and pretty quick in Jewish history, you know, only 400 years later in King Solomon's time, the rabbis institute this concept. But the rabbis had a very strong basis in the Torah. Now, those of you who come to our Shabbos morning learning, in the Be'er Gola of the Maharal, So the Maharal over there explained that really the Torah purposely worded it this way. The Torah was alluding to the rabbis, I want you to institute this. I'm not going to make it prohibited yet. But when you see the time is fit, then go tell the Jews to do this. The Maharal has this whole explanation that the Torah left codes for the rabbis, and the whole idea of an asmachta is that if you look closely at what the Torah is telling you, the Torah is giving you a concept that the Torah is saying, I won't prohibit yet, but I'm leaving you an understanding that this is fit to be prohibited when the rabbis see fit. You guys with me? But that's a whole development of the Maharal, which is not in line with Maimonides. Meaning he goes head to head with the Rambam off the bat. He doesn't tell you he's going head-to-head with the Rambam, but he does. He quotes the Rambam without telling you it's the Rambam, and he says, and it's obviously not, and then he quotes the Rambam word for word without saying he's quoting the Rambam. So he's not, it doesn't go in line with the Rambam. But at any rate, back to the Ramban. So the Ramban says, so the rabbis forbade, the rabbis told us we have to wash our hands before eating chulin. That's an extension of the rabbinic prohibition of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. You know, they're outvoted. Not to eat truma without washing our hands. Then the Talmud says, you know, washing your hands before you eat bread is a mitzvah. The Talmud asks, what's the mitzvah? Abaye explains, it's a mitzvah to listen to the rabbis. Explains the Ramban, Hiya mitzvah zo be'atzma, that's this mitzvah itself, sheroi la'achil hakol b'tahara, that we should eat everything in purity. Amal tchila, initially the Talmud over there says, she'ino ela srach she'na'agu v'nisrechu ba, that initially it was something that just spread by osmosis, meaning the Jews saw the Kohanim that before they'd eat bread they'd wash their hands, so everyone started washing their hands before they eat bread. And then the Talmud says, wait a second, this just spread, meaning it's not really a mitzvah, you don't have to wash your hands before you eat bread, it's just like people saw the Kohanim washing, so they started washing. So to that, the Talmud answers, and furthermore, the rabbis also told us to do it. But the Talmud's telling you an interesting historical fact. The rabbis say so was not what got people to do it. People saw the Kohanim doing it, then they started doing it. And furthermore, the rabbis also told us to do it. Mishum zerah d'tumah, because of an extension of the institution that we should wash our hands for truma.
That's accepted. There's no argument against
it. There is. That's Abaye's explanation. V'rava piresh, and then Rava, Abaye's contemporary. They were extended family because they were both Kohanim, Abaye and Rava. They were both descendants of Eli HaKohen. V'rava piresh, and Rava explains, sheyesh ba'od smach midrash l'divrei Torah. Rava says, you know, there's also a support for this in the words of the Torah. U'mitzvah lishmoa, and it's also a mitzvah to listen to the rabbis. K'divrei Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, like Rabbi Elazar ben Arach taught, t'chtiv v'chol asher yigabo hazav, anything that the zav touches. V'yadav lo shataf b'mayim, and he hasn't yet washed his hands with water. That's the pasuk we quoted earlier. Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach said about that pasuk, mikan samchu chachmim nintilat yadayim min haTorah. This is the pasuk the rabbis aligned their rabbinic institution with. Technically a zav, a guy who has a flow. You remember, what's a zav? That's a guy that has some kind of disease, that he could be sitting around, and suddenly he has a flow that's similar to seed, it's similar to sperm, but it's not identical. He has some kind of thick flow that comes out, and he can't control it, and it comes out even when he isn't hard, and he doesn't always know when it came out. So a zav would walk around with a cup covering himself in order to see, did any flow come out? And he'd be tamei, and he'd be sick. And the Torah says his whole body is tamei. Yes.
What exactly is the best definition of a zav? Because let's say the article says somebody has gonorrhea.
I just told you. No, I don't think it's gonorrhea. But it doesn't fit exactly. It's similar to gonorrhea.
Is it a spiritual defilement or a physical defilement?
Well, it seems to be a physical condition that the Torah tells us when a person has it, he is spiritually defiled. Goes hand in hand.
I've heard that these days nobody can. There's no condition known as zav. That's not. I don't know. I don't even remember where I heard this.
I don't think we know what a zav is. There is a discussion in halacha whether we have a zav today, because if you want to ascend to areas of the Temple Mount where a Yisrael may ascend to, assuming we know what those areas are, so even a Yisrael who is tamei met could ascend to certain areas, but a Yisrael who is tamei keri or zav may not, meaning he has to stay further away from on the Temple Mount. So the Chasam Sofer and others discuss, do we have zavim today? And the Chasam Sofer, if I'm not mistaken, says that we are concerned that we might have zavim today. We would therefore, the Chasam Sofer discusses that a person, if he's going to go up to those areas, assuming we know where they are, so he should clean himself, he should go to the bathroom, he should go to a mikveh that's connected to a spring source, and then not go to the bathroom again, because in case he was a zav, that might come out when he goes to the bathroom. But okay, there's this Chasam Sofer I never saw inside. I don't even remember where I heard it quoted.
He could immediately go, doesn't
it? Not immediately, no, he needs Erev Shemesh. So, okay, all this gets complicated. Again, I didn't see this Chasam Sofer inside. I might have heard it from Hershel Shechter in the Shira. I don't remember where I heard it. But I haven't yet seen this Chasam Sofer inside. So don't give it too much weight. You got to see what he says inside. At any rate, so Zav has that relevance. The Tosefta says a Zav may get married. You know, I once had a chassan who had some kind of condition. It wasn't gonorrhea. The doctors didn't know what it was. But they said he's fit to get married and not contagious and nothing. Fine. The chassan calls me up about a month or two before his wedding and he says, wait a second, maybe I'm a zav. Am I allowed to get married? So the Tosefta says he's allowed. There's no prohibition. You know, when a woman is a zava, she may not be with a man. But when a man is a zav, he may be with his wife. But I didn't know, you know, I don't know of anywhere the Shulchan Aruch discusses this up. So I went to Rav Halberstam Zatzal. And this was maybe the most amazing moment I had by him. I walked in, and I told him the story, and I asked him, can the guy get married? And he said, yes, goodbye. Like that. He didn't open a book. It's like, it's not a question you get every day, right? You know, that amazed me. And he could answer me like that. Okay. So back to the Ramban. So the Ramban quoted Rava. The pasuk says anything the zav touches, and he didn't wash his hands with water. Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach said, "Mikan samchu chachamim nintidat yadayim min haTorah." The rabbis aligned washing our hands with this pasuk from the Torah, didarshinan, because we say, wait a second, it says, if the Zav touches it without washing his hands, ha'achel shelo shatav pamayim tamei, but someone else who doesn't wash his hands is defiled. So there's an indication in the pasuk that washing, without washing your hands, there's a level of defilement to them. We don't say that that's the halacha, it's not biblical, but the pasuk indicates such a concept. Umikol makom, mipnei tuma gazu. Nonetheless, the rabbinic institution stems from the concept of tuma, the biblical concept. I'll prove it to you. The rabbi said it's not only bread. Let's say you like dipping your cookies in milk. You should wash your hands before you dip them in milk. Let's say you want to dip your parsley in salt water. You should wash your hands. So we don't do this anymore today. We don't do it anymore. What? Or wet fruits, right? We don't do that, right? It says for fruits you don't do it, whatever. We don't do it anymore. Lemaisa, we don't do it. But technically, we don't know why we don't do it. Really, the rabbi said you should do it. But the Ramban says, at the end of the day, it all revolves around this biblical concept. It's all a gzeira around the biblical concept that things from concepts of tuma that's biblical. ואם תאמר שראוי למנותן מצוות מפני שהעירוב עצמו יקרא מצווה מדבריהם, if you'll tell me, so I think this is where we'll pick up next time, before we open this, even though technically it's not that long, but it'll take us another 15 minutes, better we end on time. I'll tell you, we used to run overtime by a half hour to an hour on every class we had.
That's true.
But I'm not sure that it's a good idea anymore, so... We're going to end on time and say that we'll continue Bezat Shem in 2 weeks.
How do you say we don't do